welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Now, today's guest may well be familiar to many of you. Tom Waterhouse is the son of the famous trainer Gay Waterhouse and famous bookie and father Robbie Waterhouse. And if that wasn't enough, his grandfather, Bill Waterhouse, was one of the biggest bookies in the world in the 1970s. Now, whatever you think of gambling, there's no denying that people love a flutter. In 2023, horse and sports betting in Australia was worth $6.5 billion, employing 6,500 people. In my view, Tom Waterhouse is a force of nature. At age 42, birthday today, 22 years and still going strong in business, Tom epitomises the have-a-go attitude so essential to success in a free market. So take a listen as we unpack Tom's incredible journey and chat about his new venture, the Waterhouse VC. Good morning, Tom Waterhouse. Great to have you come in and join us today. Thank you.
No, thank you. It's great to be here.
And Tom, we were just talking before we started that you and I, we both started out in business fairly early. I think you started at age 21 or 22?
Yeah, look, I started, actually my dad asked me when I was first year of uni, so I must have been 18 or 19.
Is that right?
To go and work at the track. And I worked for him and he's a great dad in that about basically just threw me always in the deep end. So I think I ran his stand for him when he went away when I was 19, and then I started being a bookie at the Dogs soon thereafter, and then by 2021 I was a bookie at the races, which was it was a lot of fun.
I know originally you were thinking about finance, but the story goes that you got to the track and within 20 minutes you'd realised you wanted to do it.
Yeah, look, I still finished. I did commerce degree at Sydney Uni and majored in finance, and I loved doing that, but the racing industry and bookmaking, there was just so much money there back then, 20 something years ago. And it was just full of energy and excitement. And also I had a big advantage in that my grandfather was biggest bookie in the world in the 60s and 70s.
Wow.
And my dad, he ran a professional betting syndicate since 1980 and was a leading bookmaker. So I had a blueprint of what to do. And you're very lucky when you're young and you have a mentor or a couple of mentors that can say, look, this is how you do it. Because then it's easy. You just follow what they say.
It's a great point that. And actually, I was going to ask you, what was it like to have famous parents and a famous grandparent like that? Well, you know, was it all advantage or was there some disadvantages to that?
You don't even think about it because that's what all you know.
Yeah.
But now looking back on it, I think what an advantage. You know, like what an amazing thing to be able to go into an industry that they have such a good understanding of, such an exciting industry. It's a huge, I've been blessed, you know, in terms of, and there's always like slight disadvantages to your advantages, but there's not for one second that I don't think how lucky I was, you know.
Excellent. And look, just on that point then, I mean, we're not talking just about you becoming a licensed bookmaker at age 20. We're talking about you then became, by age 28, the largest and most profitable on-course bookie in Australia. I mean, that's phenomenal rise, really.
Yeah, look, there were a lot of things, but there were probably three main things. Obviously, my grandfather was, I had him as a mentor and we went in a partnership when I was like 22 or something like that.
So valuable.
Great learning from him. Mm-hmm. And then my dad was a form genius. So he had this amazing like form database. So I had his form and all the learnings. I never stopped asking my dad. I still don't stop asking him questions. How do I do this? What should I do here? And then also the internet took off and I moved to Melbourne where you could offer different products than what you could in New South Wales. And I had the advantage of being able to access Betfair and see what the market was doing. It's like having access to the ticker on the stock market.
Yeah.
And a lot of the bookies hadn't picked up having a computer and stuff. So I had big advantages and also the name, the brand, the family.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to be doing that the rest of my life. And it was a highly profitable, large business. But everything changed in 2008, 2009 with a change of regulation.
Yeah, and then you had to pivot massively.
I had to pivot, because we were turning over, I think I held $6 million on Derby Day in 2008.
Oh, my goodness.
And like the favourite in the Derby would have got $500,000 in cash out of it as standing it. And the next year was lucky to get $5,000 out of it. And I thought, well, the game's up. I have to move online.
Okay.
And so we launched TomWaterhouse.com in 2009, proper launch in 2010, and within 18 months we had 250,000 customers, which was just phenomenal growth. But to put it in perspective, I turned over more as an on-course bookie in 2008 than TomWaterhouse.com turned over as an online bookie before we sold.
Yeah, okay.
So on-course bookmaking was a big business.
Yeah.
Which is easy to forget because when you go to the races now, there's no one there.
No.
But it's only 15, 20 years ago that it was all there.
And founding TomWaterhouse.com, right, that movement online, you were having to figure a lot of that out yourself, I presume. I mean, it's effectively a digital revolution.
Yeah, it was.
Starting to take place.
It was an amazing learning experience because I barely used email back in 2008.
Right.
I know that, and that sounds so foreign now, but I barely used email. Yeah. iPhone only came out in 2008.
That's right.
But, I think I had a Nokia before then or something like that.
Yeah.
And so we shifted to online and it was a big change. But you really look at what mentors and what's going well, and a few of the other bookies had moved online and their businesses were booming.
Yeah.
So the likes of Sporting Bet, Sports Bet, Cole Tidy, Alan Iskander in Melbourne, they were all moving online. And so you could go, well, what are they doing? That looks like it's pretty good. How do I sort of use that as a blueprint to copy and to basically go in that space and then find your own little path within it?
Yeah.
That was a huge learning experience. And there was so much we didn't know, so many mistakes we made, but those mistakes and learning it ultimately led to us selling to William Hill and then running William Hill's business in Australia from 20.
You were part of a roll-up effectively,
yeah.
Right? But then they got you to become the managing director. So they obviously saw something in you because you weren't the biggest part of that roll-up, were
you?
No,
we were the smallest. They paid $670 million for Sporting Bet and Centrebet, and we were a small add-on. But they asked me to run that business because, well, we had to learn everything. In terms of starting a digital bookmaking business, we went from 100, from 3 people to 100 plus people.
Yeah.
And when you're starting something out from scratch, you have to learn the IT providers, the CRM, the trading function, the digital marketing function, the advertising, the branding. And so if you're bringing 3 businesses together, if you've got someone that works 10 years, 15 years, they might be the best marketeer of all time, but how do they know how it connects into trading or into finance or into all the other functions? And they basically said, well, you've just done that. Come and run it.
Do it again, yeah. And did you feel prepared for that? Did you feel that everything you'd done prior to that was leading
you? If you'd asked me in 2013, 2014, I would have said, oh, I'm completely prepared. But looking back on it, definitely not.
No, sure. Hindsight's easy, but what may you have done differently? What key assumption did you guys make, which in fact turned out not to be the case?
So you assume that lines of the P&L that you can drive efficiencies by just moving cost lines.
Right.
And that if you can do things to turbocharge revenue, that revenue, there won't be competitor change or change in regulation. So we got rid of a lot of people to try and take the cost down. But those people had helped build what William Hill paid $670 million for. And even though it was hard to maybe see, how do they directly contribute to getting that revenue? There were some key parts to that business that William Hill bought that we got rid of that actually impacted turnover significantly.
Okay, interesting.
And then there was regulatory change. We tried to grow in play through a product called Click to Call. William Hill bought a large credit business that didn't go as well with the increasing tax because it was lower margin. But there were several mistakes. And I'd come from being an on-course bookie to an online startup betting business just with my family. There's no proper reporting board and managing. We had 500 people working in that William Hill Australia business, multiple offices in Tel Aviv and Philippines and Australia, and we had 170 developers. Well, I hadn't run a business going and reporting to a board in the UK, and so I was very lucky. A man called Steve Vamos, who ran Microsoft in Australia, ran Apple in Australia, 9MSN, so reported to Bormer, like Kerry Packer, ran Xero in New Zealand, on the board of David Jones, Telstra, and he came in and mentored me and basically said, look, this is how you run a larger organization. This is how you, your priorities and objectives, how you cascade that down to a bigger, wider organization. And he was instrumental in making me get comfort in running an organization that size. And he was tremendous. He was really, really helpful.
So Tom, are you good at taking input? I mean, you mentioned your granddad and it's amazing how much influence our parents and grandparents can have on us. But you were very willing, and you seem like a willing participant in that journey, that important journey. But it seems like the same again with Steve here, that you were going, okay, tell me what's going on.
It was a lot more polite conversation with Steve than it was with my grandfather.
I can imagine.
It's easy now.
Do you think the learnings were slow because of that?
Yeah, probably. It's funny, my grandfather and I, I loved him so much. He was such a great man. But we used to have non-stop yelling matches on the way back from the races. And he'd be like, you absolute idiot, you imbecile, you got no idea. Yeah. And but that was great. It's one thing to love a grandparent or a relative, but when it's all love and there's no hardness, you don't see it all.
No.
And I felt I loved growing up with him because he was such a friendly, cuddly grandfather. Yeah. Always enjoyed spending time with him. But when I got to see the raw, hard side of him, I loved him way more because you saw everything. And he was tough. He was really tough and used to give it to me, like in terms of telling me what I did wrong.
But I mean, in a way, it's gold because business is tough and the free market's going to find you out. And you know, that took a long time for me to develop that edge, really. I think a mentor can really help with that.
Yeah, you need a blueprint.
So you were getting that input from Steve. I know you were there for, was it 3 years as MD there?
So from 2014 to 2018.
Tell us what happened then.
So there was, again, tax and regulation became tougher in Australia. So
it's regulated.
Yeah, it's really regulated.
The regulatory area just kind of adds to the complexity.
I agree. It's every time you make any sort of decent profit there, it's just a red flag to the regulator, tax them more. And so there was further round of consolidation in 2018, and William Hill sold to the roll-up between Crown Bet, Bet Easy, PokerStars, and Flutter. And so I had no job after that because basically it was consolidated into a larger entity and I had a 2-year non-compete.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what am I going to do? And to your point, I realized that B2C was tough and the real opportunity, it's a $1 trillion industry, the gambling industry, the real opportunity in that sector was in the supply, the picks and shovels. So B2B. And I basically said to her, we had 170 developers in Sydney, another 100 in the Philippines. I said to a handful of them, I said, look, let's go around the world and analyze the tech, the suppliers, and see if we can invest in them. So we started Waterhouse VC just on 5 years ago now. And that was the area. We knew that there was the opportunity in the space where they were making all the money with the supply side because what had happened, everything shifted to digital marketing. Mm-hmm. And the way that the large operators were differentiating was on product differentiation, so on user experience. So if you had a better user experience like a bet with mates or a cash out functionality or a voice betting functionality or you had more odds or more markets, that was a point of difference to not only bring customers in, but make those customers more sticky, increase player value, lifetime retention. And that was where the large operators were differentiating. So that was the beginning of Waterhouse VC.
Yes. So you also started Listed Reserve, right?
So the CFO of William Hill was on from, I reckon, 2014, basically saying the world's changed, Bitcoin's taken off, and you've got to get into Bitcoin. And we, William Hill needed to increase revenue, obviously, when I was running that business, and decrease cost. And so we looked for lower cost places. So we built up the Philippines from one person to a couple of hundred in terms of the William Hill Australia business. But we looked at in Taiwan, in China, in India, a whole bunch of places. And we actually came across in 2014, 2015, 2016, a whole bunch of operators that were crypto betting operators turning over more than William Hill were globally, and they were a FTSE 100 company.
Wow.
So realized he was actually right, CFO. And when it finished, he was going, well, where am I going to go? And he ran Listed Reserve. And so the family invested in that business along with another one of close friends, a man that Ari Klinger, who runs No Brand, another venture capital firm. And that Listed Reserve business has been growing great. I don't have any active involvement in it, except I'm a big cheerleader of the ex-CFO at William Hill Australia and what they've been able to do.
And what are your thoughts on Bitcoin? Because, I mean, it seems like it's here to stay and it seems like it's beginning to change the game around an alternative global way of paying for things, right?
Yep.
But it's also pretty volatile, and the powers that be don't like it at all, do they?
Look, I don't know. It's not our area of focus.
No.
You know, so in terms of, I've seen its amazing rise since 2014 or whatever. And what's been eye-opening for me is that a lot of these large companies are putting on their balance sheet and that they've allowed these ETFs. And then you've seen like a sovereign nation like El Salvador take it up. But that's just reading the news. I have no particular insight in that. I just focus on one industry and one little sub part of the industry being the suppliers. I read about it, but the same way as I'd like to read about Apple or Microsoft.
It's certainly difficult to know where that's going to be or that's going to go. But I suppose a lot of these larger firms are having a bit of a, you know, they're having a bit of an each way bet, and they've got to be on it in some way, shape or form.
The area that I find interesting in terms of Bitcoin or the crypto space, and that, not necessarily Bitcoin, but it might be like USDT those stable coins, is that you saw what an amazing job the Coates family, Denise Coates and the family did. If you said in 2000, could they go and surpass William Hill, Coral, Betfred, Victor Chandler?
Yeah, yeah, no one would.
You just go, it's just impossible. I had two shops.
Yeah.
And they realized that the global betting space was far bigger than just UK.
Yeah.
And they innovated and improved the in-play product, the user experience, and they just blew them away and done such an amazing job. I think she's the largest taxpayer in the UK. She's got she's a dame or something. Amazing. Yeah. Like, it's just such a success story and so incredible for the gambling industry to have someone achieve so much.
A genuine disruption.
And also give back. Like, they own Stoke football team. They've just done an amazing job. But what's happened in the last 5 years, you've seen this next round of innovators. So the likes of, you've probably seen in the BRW Rich List, like the likes of Ed Craven or Tim Heath with sportsbet.io, they've innovated and changed the game. So they've used crypto and this new wave of technology and customer interface and customer interaction and marketing, and they're probably the biggest betting companies in the world. Like, Stake.com is just massive. And it's 20 years since we last saw that big change. And so for me, that's very interesting. But as an investment point of view, I just want to stick to my knitting.
You finished up effectively the Stars Group acquires William Hill. You've got a 2-year non-compete. And so you pivot into Waterhouse VC, which is effectively your own fund.
Knew that there was opportunity in the $1 trillion market was the supplier side. And then our first deal, we put $600,000 into a odds provider of racing odds. It provided the integrity to the racing bodies, and then it provided the odds to the bookmakers. And thought, well, this might be an interesting product because it may expand into further jurisdictions outside Australia. US is opening up. And so we put $600,000 into that, and we're able to negotiate to buy an option in it for 19.9%. That deal went well for us, and we went, actually, let's not concentrate on investing. Let's concentrate on options in suppliers. And then there was luck of timing in that the interest rate environment, interest rates increased, and a lot of the businesses we were looking at were struggling to then get funding. So if the ability for us to buy options in those businesses was much easier than it was in 2020, 2021.
So look, just the uninitiated, Tom, right? So effectively what you're doing is you've now gone global. So you've now opened up the world in terms of where you might find these assets, these, you know, digital, innovative, B2B, you mentioned picks and shovels, right?
Yep.
So you're looking for these businesses. You find one you like the look of.
Yep.
And you open up a dialogue, and you effectively, rather than, so you price the business, you might call that a strike price. You say, look, we think your business is worth X.
Yep.
And we'd like to buy options based on that.
Correct.
That we can exercise over the next 1 or 2 years.
So we want 3-year option. We want the time value of the option. Yeah.
And that's private and listed companies, is it? So if it's a private company, how are you valuing that again in 3 years? I mean, it's a dividend play, is it?
Some of them are dividends, some of them were sold an option. So I'll give you an example of how we look for businesses, and then I'll give you an example of how we've sold an option type.
Yeah.
So for instance, we thought that racing may take off in the US. We thought that esports may take off in the US because they need product in the US. They've only got basketball, NFL, baseball, they haven't got product all year round and they've got plenty of gaps. It's not like racing that's wall to wall here. And so we thought maybe esports is a filler product. And so we looked at all of the different esports providers out there, spoke to many of them, spoke to a lot of the companies that were using this data supplier. We then went, actually, we think the best one is this one, a company called Odin in based in Prague. We then had conversations with them, spoke with the people that they were dealing with, what's their uptime, what's their service level ability, what contracts do they have to have provide the data. We then went and visited their business in Prague, spoke to their team, looked at their models, then spoke to the people that they had agreements to provide the data with, and then went, actually, well, this is an interesting space. Can we negotiate to buy an option in that business? Now, we've never executed that option. We haven't got into the money with that option.
Just staying on that, right, the business in Prague, what's in it for them? I'm a vendor, right? I've got a business. I've done pretty well. I may or may not need cash. So you're looking for something that can scale, that can be the next big thing. What's in it for me to do a strike price today? Are you giving me a premium for that?
We're paying for the option.
Yeah.
And then we're also, they're getting to evaluation. They're like, well, actually, we'd be very happy if we got to that in 3 years.
Okay.
But by having us on board, we've got many of the leading people in the industry in our fund.
Okay. So you're bringing human capital. You're bringing some expertise.
Yeah, we don't do any active involvement. We don't take any board.
So it's non-exec.
Non-executive, no management, no like we don't provide any work.
And you don't go on the board?
Don't do anything,
okay.
No.
Okay.
But there's a big thing for people in the industry that are in our fund. They'll go, actually, they've looked at this business. We probably go in to do an option in less 1 in 100 businesses we would do an option in.
Yeah, okay.
And we do a lot of work before we do the option. So, for instance, there was a Canadian business that were listing on the Canadian Stock Exchange. They wanted to sell us a 19.9% option. Our CTO, who's head engineer at Qantas, William Hill, been in the industry for a long, long time, ultra experienced, he said, look, I don't think the tech can scale enough. I don't think you should do the option. I'm not technical. I'm like, oh, it sounds exciting. We should do it.
Yeah,
he said, no, don't do it.
Okay.
We didn't do the deal. Thankfully, we didn't do that deal. A business out of Vietnam emailed me on Christmas Eve a year and 6 months ago and said, look, we've got this tech stack. We've run out of money. We did a token sale in 2018. We need funding. We need help. Would you be open to doing a deal with our business or whatever? I'm like, oh, I don't know this business. Never heard of them. Based in Vietnam. And I don't know about these developers. Token sale.
Yeah.
Flicked it onto the CTO. He had a call with their head engineer, looked at their code and went, actually, it's very impressive.
Right.
We bought an option in that and then was able to get it. They got investment a few weeks off the back of us doing an option with them.
Okay.
And then we sold the option. We never converted the option, sold the option for 23 times our option value within 5 months.
Right.
So that's a success story. There's been plenty of duds.
Yeah, sure. So whatever calculation you've used to come up with the strike price for the option, you'd use a similar valuation in 2 or 3 years' time and decide what you want to do.
Correct.
If it's a private company.
Correct.
If it's a listed company, there's no problem.
Yeah, or we try and find a buyer that needs. We're looking for businesses that provide a great service that we know there's a need. So we basically spend all our time thinking like we're an operator. What does
who's
an operator
gonna buy
need?
You know, so you're really figuring out who's going
to
buy it.
Correct. Where's the end? So today we spoke to this morning before this meeting, we had an amazing call with a business that changes the user experience.
Yeah.
If you like betting on NBA, when you go to your betting site's website, it's all NBA stuff with offers around NBA. It's not the usual user experience. Great business, great tech, very good team. But I'm thinking in my head, where does that end up in 3 years or two years? You know, that's the thought that's going through my head. Not, it's thinking as an operator, will there be a need and will it be easy to integrate? Because what I saw at William Hill, we had 500 products in the roadmap. Once you were in the William Hill ecosystem, you had very sticky revenue, but to get in the ecosystem was really hard. So I'm thinking all the time, can it get into the ecosystem and is there a natural?
Yeah. So you're really bringing this 15 years of niche expertise in a way to the investment side of the equation.
Correct.
And say, okay. And it's hard, yak. I mean, you look at 100, you might end up getting involved in one.
Correct. And it's so much travel because for us, the meeting place to meet all the businesses is wherever the global gambling conferences are on. So like just in these first few months of the year, London Ice Gambling Conference, SBC in Rio, iGaming Next in New York, SBC in New Jersey, portfolio managers just got back from Malta from the big conference there. Then you've got Amsterdam. Then you've got Portugal. It just is always, but we do back-to-back meetings for days. And there's nothing like having face-to-face where you can say, okay, well, is this what you're trying to achieve? Why are you trying to do that? And also your contact base, and also you getting such a better understanding of the industry. And so we just want to focus on one industry. It's much easier for an analyst to understand the value of Tabcorp or Entain or Caesars. It's very hard for someone not in the industry to understand whether a data supplier or a voice betting solution or a platform, like, is what value is it? You know, they're currently generating very little revenue. Is it worth lots, little?
It's one of the hardest parts of, I mean, we've really only learned in the last 20 years that a business with sometimes no revenue, but definitely no earnings can be really valuable, right? I mean, that's a new phenomenon, really. And now we're starting to have to price IP. And that's not easy to price because we're trying to look at utilization and utility, and we're going over what time frame and how much money does it need and what else is going to change in the meantime. So it's a high risk game, but you have a high risk tolerance. I mean, do you enjoy running this fund?
It's not really because we're buying options at what we think is
a
really great value.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very smart move.
So we're basically we're betting on 100 to 1 shots.
Yeah.
And we're thinking we're getting much better odds.
It's very clever. So you effectively, your risk is your premium.
Correct.
And the time value of money.
Correct.
Effectively.
And our time.
Okay.
Our time. And so there's three elements to the fund.
Yeah.
That's the first pillar.
Yeah.
And that's how we're 31 times our investors' money over 5 years.
It's an incredible return. I mean, I was going to ask you, is that sustainable?
No, well, I think, and I'll run you through the three pillars. And so 31 times our investors' money, we've compounded 100% per annum. Are we going to compound at 100% per annum as we grow?
Yeah.
It's a much harder task.
As you get a bigger number.
Warren
Buffett had the same problem.
Correct. We will close our fund. We plan to close our fund at $500 million.
Okay.
Because we think to have a good chance of getting above market return is much harder.
Okay.
If we were to grow to...
And you're at 65 now.
Probably 70 million now. So, yeah. So we do with pillar one, we're finding options in a core area that we understand really well. We've had several option deals come off, but we've found a sweet spot in... one of our investors said, look, our son works at a large betting company. There's this... Everyone's talking about this young guy. He's unbeatable in tennis. You should go and meet him. So I went and met the guy. He was... ultra impressive. We meet a lot of groups that think that they can win betting, and they're either had a period of positive variance, either like they have some small edge, but it's not sustainable, or they're just deluded. You know, like it's very hard to win betting because if you bet on the Sydney Swans on the weekend, you can win on that match, but the average bettor is betting regularly and there's margin against them. So it's very hard to win when you bet regularly. But there's a few groups around the world that are hugely successful. So in the UK, Tony Bloom, who owns Brighton Football Club, probably the world's best soccer punter. David Walsh, who owns MoMA Museum and Jelco, probably the world's best racing syndicate. They win huge amounts of money because they're able to put into their statistical models thousands of factors that can predict the truer probability of that event than the bookmakers can. So... you can win, like Jim Simmons with Renaissance Technologies. They've won huge amounts through their data models on the stock market, but it's hard and you have to put in a lot of work. And so when we met this young guy, we were very skeptical, but spoke to him, got one of my dad's analysts to speak with him. He used to work with Tony Bloom. I called Tony Bloom. I said, look, is this guy good? He's like, he's very good. We're very sad to see him leave. We optioned up his business and he tripled turnover gross win for 3 years on a row. We converted the option at 1x last year's earnings. And pillar two of our strategy, we've now optioned up and converted multiple betting syndicates. We have a profit share, so not the downside risk of these syndicates. We have a profit share in them, but that's pillar two of our strategy. So we have hopefully great capital growth in pillar one, finding and negotiating options and then converting them or selling them. Pillar two, we've optioned up many betting syndicates.
So you said there's sort of 10 or 12 around the world that are successful,
correct.
Right? So there's limited options to do that, I presume.
And the only time we see great value is there's probably three times when they're very young and they don't know how to set up an organization. So we've helped him scale from himself to 23 analysts. He's got global distribution. He's a much bigger operation now. Now, he may have done that completely on his own without us, but there's great to have someone investing alongside the business that has been in the industry already 20 plus years. He's just starting out. It's
your option premium gives them some cash, right?
Correct.
Okay. It also gives them some credibility, and they can perhaps leverage that and go and borrow some money.
Yeah.
Is that really what goes
raise
on?
Raise money, contacts.
Yeah.
Just even the conversation of who's the best HR recruiter, who's the best tech company, third party tech, what are the best banking solutions? What are the best, we live and breathe it. You know, and
I presume you're looking for the guys who are emerging, really. That's what you're looking for, is tomorrow's
in the very beginning, a professional betting group that's facing regulatory change in restrictions and regulations and wants to go into a new market, or a group that's much older and wants to retire.
Okay.
So they're the three areas we've now optioned up three betting syndicates, converted two. So that's pillar two of the strategy. So pillar one's given us all our uplift. That's how the investors got 31 times. Pillar two is a dividend play. We're a fixed unit trust. We have to distribute all realized gains and dividends each year. So, and then what we've found is our investors, because they like what we're doing, have put money back into the fund. So we sit in cash. And at the beginning, we were thinking, well, do we put it in term deposits, in bonds? And the families for probably 10 years has followed a 13F strategy. So we look at the 16 best performing long-term funds that have beaten the S&P over 30 years. And each quarter when they release their 13F filing, which has all their positions, the portfolio weighting, how much in each position, what they bought and sold, we have an analyst here and an analyst overseas going through the 13F filing, applying our proprietary filters to their stock picks. So we have to go into only positions that those 16 funds have got a greater than 1% portfolio position in, trading under 20 times PE, got greater than 20% revenue growth for 5 years in a row, and very little debt. And so it normally narrows down to around 15 positions. We're then evenly weight against those 15 positions. We've outperformed the S&P since we started doing it by 7.9%. Our average PE ratio is 13 times. S&P, I think, is trading at 22, 23 times. Our median growth rate is 27%. The median growth rate of the S&P is 18. Our Sharpe ratio is 1.07. We're not trying to beat the S&P. We're not doing anything very smart with that third pillar. But we just say to our investors, look, we're not trying to, for the sake, deploy money for the sake of deploying money. Your money sits here in pillar three. The family are happy to be in this equity strategy. It may not be the best world's best equity strategy. You might find better, but it's a solid equity strategy. But we're going to be hard to beat against any equity strategy, because on top of that equity strategy, we get a dividend play out of the professional betting syndicates, and we get capital growth when the options come out off.
Yeah. So it's a wholesale fund, presumably.
So, only wholesale investors,
And you know, what's the kind of minimum to come in, get involved with you?
So we had a minimum that of million for the first 4.5 years, and now it's just you have to be a sophisticated wholesale investor.
So the rules for that, there's various rules for that, but it's about $250,000. And
I think your minimum investment, I think you without getting an account certificate and all that, is $500,000.
Is it? Okay.
And then you have to get, if you don't put in $500,000, you have to go through all of the thing of showing that you're high net wealth or sophisticated investor.
And are you looking to, I mean, you're open at the moment to raising, you've
got- The fund's open. The fund's never been closed.
You've got a lot of headroom there.
Yeah, the fund's never been closed. And for us, I think if we can keep our head down and just finding great option deals, well, we're going to get to closing point. And that's the aim of just, and then just basically keep going.
You've got great sort of heritage in this kind of gaming punting area, right? What is it about human nature that finds it so fascinating to have a bet?
Well, people have been betting since the beginning of time, and sort of you're betting when you make an investment in anything, you're putting your money where your mouth is, you know, and the issue with betting, why it's hard, is because you've got significant margin against you regularly. But if you have a bet with your mate and he says one thing and you say the other, well, it's a much more in bet, because you're not taking a margin out. One person wins. The issue is, and why it's hard to win betting, is because you've got margin against you. But it's really people are putting thought, well, I've thought long and hard in the state of origin. I think New South Wales is value because of this. And the excitement of being proved you're right. You know, it's like having a bet when you play your mate in tennis or in golf. Yeah, and then there's some people that are very good at analysing and taking very good bets in terms of risk payoff. And then there are other people that just go, well, actually, I just want that dopamine hit of excitement all the time. So it's very different.
Mm. So if according to IBIS last year, horse and sports betting in Australia is worth $6.4 billion, right? And, you know, the earnings of that in that sector, there's about 835 companies, make it about 15% net. If you look at all, there's a million companies in Australia that operate. There's a million that actually employ people. And the average net profit's about 9.7%. And interestingly, there's the staffing element of the gaming world is only 5%, which is quite low because of the tech shift that's gone on. So this is a pretty profitable area if you get it right. Even with the regulatory kind of demands and the shifts in that.
So, yeah, there's a huge amount of money to be made in gambling globally. It's a massive industry. You find that the operators, so FanDuel had their first quarter of profit 2 quarters ago in the US. It's been opened up since 2018. They've had Fantasy before that. But that's only one operator. It has 6 years of operation, 1 quarter of profit. In Australia, well, who are the profitable operators here in Australia? Well, you've got Tabcorp, but they've been struggling in terms of, they haven't been growing. I think share price down 40% in the last year.
Sliding market share.
Yeah, sports bets seeing revenue decline.
Yeah.
They're profitable. Entain is profitable here, but you've got a whole raft of other operators that are line ball or loss making.
Yeah.
A lot of entrants that came into the market here lost their shirts coming in. The UK has seen all the operators, the share prices have just been killed. Now, I'm not crying poor for the operators.
Sure. But always another side to it.
But then you see the people that are looking at stuff differently, like Dabble here in Australia. Who would have thought a startup 3 or 4 years ago could come and make inroads? That's an amazing success story, what they've done in Australia and being acquired or partly acquired by Tabcorp. That was a brilliant investment by Tim Heath and the Yola Group. You've seen what Tim Heath's done with sportsbet.io, and you've seen what Ed Craven's done with Stake. They're incredible operators and they're making great profits, but just to put up a bookmaking business and go, well, look, it's a lucrative industry, I'd warn against that.
When you're going around the world looking, you know, for as part of your work in Waterhouse VC, there's an old saying that money follows management. You're looking for talent, really, are you? At some level, to what extent is it the leader?
We love businesses that are at least, they've got to be generating revenue. So there's a big thing between an idea and there's lots of people who've got a great idea, but even if they've got a small amount of revenue, they've at least gone through the pain of getting a client on board, onboarded, interaction so we can at least speak with someone. And then we're looking for something that's critical. You know, like we go, actually, we know people that need that service, that really want that and haven't been able to build it. And these people have been able to do it. And if we go, well, look, it's just a no-brainer for this person to take that on board. We're like, well, it's a no-brainer for us to negotiate to buy an option. And that's what we're looking for. But we see often there's some founders that go, this is amazing, I'm really excited, it's a great space. And then there's just some founders that it feels like for us to let the business fail, they would rather die. And they're nonstop. And because we're not pushy investors, we're not active in terms of things, it's like we take an option, we hope you do well, but we're optioning up lots of businesses. We see some that just, the founders just don't have the same ambition as other founders, you know, and that's life, is it?
Okay, yeah. I mean, in that technology area, you must come across this a lot. We do a lot of technology deals and we do find there's a certain genre of owner that has a fanciful idea around valuation. So you must get to a point where you see something, it lines up, but you just can't agree the right option price.
Correct. Yeah. For us, we're looking for value all the time of what we think is value. And there's also one other thing I think is very interesting is that the amount of people to create significant businesses now is dramatically reduced. We just did an option deal with a business last week, and the guy is ultra talented, but he's built the whole working tech solution, completely working. You can scan a QR code, have the bet. Everything works. He's got a financial background, never done a day's coding in his life, and coded up the whole user experience, everything, through using code from ChatGPT. No other person in his team. So it's amazing that someone, he's obviously ultra intelligent person, but he hasn't had to go to coding school. He just has to know the right prompts to put into AI. And he's built a product that we've optioned up at half a million US dollar valuation with just him as the only person. It's really incredible. Like, you wouldn't, that's not possible 10 years ago.
But I mean, what it does is it drives innovation, doesn't it? It sort of democratizes commerce even more. I mean, the liberal democracies have been great, right? If you look at what's happened in the last 200 years. But I think it's only just the beginning. I really think that the internet, you know, for all its drawbacks, and there are many, we spoke earlier, but the democratization of information, the ability for people to innovate and to bring their talent to bear, I think has never been greater. I think the opportunities ahead of us are phenomenal.
Oh, I agree with you. And I think there's never been a better time to go into business or be alive if you've got get up and go, because you have got all the tools at your fingertips. Like, you used to get the amazing knowledge of what was the cutting edge of business 100 years ago, you had to be at Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge and learn from the best professors. You can watch a video now, or you can prompt GPT and get the answers to everything. It's amazing.
Well, interesting. I'm an investor on the board of a company in Western Sydney, and we're creating 3D metal printed valves for Gilmore's, who are sending up rockets. They're taking up satellite dishes. There's a whole emerging aerospace area around putting comms, you know, using space to put dishes, and the demand for that apparently is off the chart. But you couldn't, you know, we can 3D metal print a high grade valve, starting with, you know, some powder.
It's amazing. It's just incredible.
Good stuff. So, look, fantastic for you to come in today, and fantastic to get to know some of your story. Just going back to your dad for a minute, I really like that idea that your dad let you, he unleashed you to do stuff, right? But you know, Richard Branson's parents were apparently similar.
I remember him to do stuff, reading his book, Losing My Virginity or whatever, and they just dropped him, were driving
dropped
along
him off,
and said, go and swim in the river or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and
Find
your way home.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's a little bit different now, but I do think that, you know, we need to encourage ourselves as parents to kind of let our kids make mistakes and go and try stuff, because I do think it helps. It certainly helps in business.
Correct. And that's why we love businesses that are generating just a little bit of revenue, because once you've got a little bit of money in your hands, you can pivot, you can go somewhere, you're just thinking then, but pre any revenue coming in, it's just an idea. You know, and that's and I think once you're in business and you just get that taste of a little bit of money.
Yes. And look, we see that a lot. We see technically biased businesses where they've built a platform, and they've used the philosophy, we will build it and they will come. And often they don't, and there's no revenue. But you're right. If you can move to revenue, you've really overcome probably the biggest hurdle. And the learnings from that are valuable to people like you. Look, Tom, great to have spent some time with you. Great to have got to know you. I'm sure that our listeners will be delighted. All business owners generally are listeners. I'm sure they'll be delighted to have heard your story. More power to you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate
it. Thanks for
coming
in. Thank you. Take care. Well, there you have it. Such an enjoyable chat. I loved how open and frank Tom was, and so positive about the future. When you can say, I'll be doing this for the rest of my life, you're normally onto something. Thanks to Tom. And if you want to know more about the Waterhouse VC, the details will be in the show notes. Now, a quick shout out to our sponsors, Oasis Partners. If you are thinking about your options, feel free to get in touch. With more than 500 successful deals completed, we know a thing or two about getting a deal done. And we are also the most discreet operator in the market. If you like this content, be sure to tell your friends. And if you're feeling very generous, leave a like. Only good ones, please. We're very sensitive. Thanks for listening.